Well, friends, I'm going to ask if you'll pardon me today if I depart from our usual discussion and discoursing and maybe go a little bit into the travel business and give you somewhat of a little travelogue. Now, indeed, this is perhaps not as edifying, not as spiritual, not as intellectual as maybe you would be accustomed to hearing. But I can tell you one thing, to me it was very inspirational. And I only wish I could have had each and every one of you with us during the past 2 or 3 weeks. You were with us in prayer and thought. Many times we found ourselves thinking about the brethren back home. We had a nice little family of our own. There were some 30 brethren together, coming from 8 different states, some as far away as California, and some as north as Maine, and some as south as Maryland. And they all seemed to be drawn together out of a love and a desire to get a little more familiarity with the land and the geography and the historic scenes of the book which we love so much. Now, all of us thought of this in terms of a vacation. This was to be, you know, no pilgrimage. It was not going to be something unusual, but rather we were to go there to get the most profit from these 2 weeks. And it was conceived of as a period of physical refreshment, but more than that, of spiritual upliftment. And believe me, there was little physical refreshment. There was physical wear and tear, but there was a considerable amount of spiritual inspiration in all that we saw. And all I would like to do now is just to give you a few of the high points. I wish I could give you a day-by-day, hour-by-hour account, because it was so interesting. But all I will do is just touch upon some of the places we were and what a few of the things we saw. We left New York on schedule. However, we did not become airborne until 7 hours beyond our scheduled flight time. One of the motors or engines in the plane was defective, and rather than risking a 4,000-mile flight, they decided to have another plane. We started, therefore, with a physical handicap. We were 7 hours behind schedule to start with. Finally, the plane did take off at 2:30 in the morning, and we stopped in Germany first, and then went down to Rome for a little stop, and then on to Athens, Greece for a stop, and then out to Cairo, Egypt. We came into Cairo, Egypt about 2:30 in the morning. We were delayed at the airport, customs, because of 2 bags of brethren in our party being lost. Apparently they are on the plane and going down to Tehran, Iran, and were not dropped off at Cairo. But the brethren were not too upset by this. They merely had the TWA passenger representative call ahead, and they in turn were going to get the baggage brought back by the return flight. And so we got into the bus at about 3 o'clock in the morning and boarded the bus through the dimmed out and quiet town of Cairo, Egypt. We went through the central part of town. We were surprised at how modern it was. But yet there were the palm trees, there was the signs of the statuary and the domes, the mosques, the Byzantine kind of architecture that made us know that we were in another part of the world. And we drew up into the Mena House Hotel. The Mena House Hotel may be familiar to some of you because when Brother Russell had his tour around the world and stayed in Egypt, he stayed at this very hotel. It was a hotel that was built, I'm sure, somewhere around the 1890s and was the last word in luxury at that time. Elegant, very lovely carvings, and all in its woodwork. But the reason why this was selected as our hotel to stay at was not the physical elegance of the place. Because this, though there were more expensive hotels and up-to-date modern Statler Hilton hotels, but the reason why we went here was soon apparent, because when we got into our room, and every room had the same exposure, and we opened up the doors that led onto a little balcony, right in our own backyard was this wonderful monument, this pyramid. It's just as though you could reach out and touch the pyramid. It was right within a quarter of a mile of where we were sleeping that night. And it was the most inspirational sight. We just opened those doors, and there the silhouette of this huge testimony to God's plan stood before us. We were tired, we were really weary after about 18, 24 hours without sleep. But we were just so filled with excitement that when we fell into bed, we were not too, you know, concerned about getting up at 7 o'clock with only about 3 hours sleep, because we knew we had to get going that morning on our first tour throughout Cairo. We were a little tired, but I tell you, the morale of the brethren and the eagerness, the devotion, and the real dedication to knowing and to learning and to coming to find what we were seeking was wonderful. If you get a group that is not so interested in the same things, I can see where such a trip would be difficult. But here they're all concerned about this one thing: how do we learn more about our dear God and His plan? And we were all unified from the very outset, and we were all anxious to help one another. And that spirit, brethren, of cooperation, was enabled us to, you know, forget about the sleepless nights and some of the hard riding and the driving that we had to do for 14, 15 hours at a time. Our first morning was spent going through the ancient Valley of the Dead, called Memphis, where most of the pharaohs of Egypt were buried. 250 miles down the Nile, there is at Thebes, the Valley of the Kings, where their monuments and where their temples and where their grave deeds are inscribed in stone and where their statues are raised to 200 feet in height. But here, outside of Cairo, roughly 10 miles in this barren desert land, was where they buried their dead pharaohs. And there were something like 11 pyramids, small in size and many of them all broken down. I wish I could have some pictures that we had taken to illustrate what we are saying, to bring you there more visually, but they just had not all gotten in, and some of them, frankly, did not come out as well as we had hoped. But I'm sure that at our convention, some of the brethren will bring their pictures, and I know some of the young people's meetings are going to be built around the pyramid and some of the experiences and views of Palestine. We were very interested in getting, for the first 2 hours, a guided tour of the oldest pyramids. They call Saqqara, or Memphis, the tomb of the dead. And we were literally given a wonderful background into the Egyptian history by a man who was quite an Egyptologist. He was hired by our own tour guide for that very purpose. And as he lectured about some of the customs, he was able to point right to the pyramid, or right to the tomb, or right to the plan that he had before him. And we were able to see history come to life. And we learned a lot about it, completely around the fact that their ruler is divine, and that he represents the reincarnation of many gods, and that he therefore has to be the only word, the only will, and whatever he says goes, and how they went to excesses to exalt themselves and to preserve their future, the way in which they mummified each pharaoh, the way in which they believed that great lie that Satan had propounded to the then very Garden of Eden: ye shall not surely die. And thus, in carrying out that lie, how the adversary has so compounded the darkness of it that the whole lives of millions of slaves was doing nothing but serving the will of the pharaoh, who in turn was only preparing himself for his own death and his own survival. That is how, when we read the hieroglyphics of the Egyptians, how we can understand some of their rituals. How it is, for example, that the pyramids are all built on the west side of the Nile, even though the quarries from which they got their stones were all on the east side of the Nile, or from 400 miles down the Nile and had to be shipped up during the heavy season. And when you think of the Great Pyramid of Giza alone, that there were 2.5 million blocks of stone, some of those stones being 150 tons each, and averaging 2.5 tons, 2.5 million blocks, covering 500,000 square feet, and rising 481 feet in the perpendicular into the air. You begin to see the problem of transportation of these huge granite and sandstone blocks. Yet they were dragged miles across barren desert and across the Nile River because of the belief that birth is only in the east and death is only in the west, because the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. And because of a belief of that, the lives of millions of slaves were lost in endlessly dragging these huge stones countless miles, satisfy superstition and ignorance and darkness and blasphemy. We have no idea how these ideas have so engulfed and darkened the minds and the lives of men. And as we saw more about the symbolism of the Egyptian culture, oh, we just said in our heart, thank God, that the time will come when those poor wrecks of humanness, when they come back in the millennial, and when those slaves will realize the true beauties of resurrection, and when they will realize that not man but Jehovah, a God of wisdom, love, and power, is their creator, what a wonderful contrast they will have in that millennial process. How they will be able to really see the complete blackness of sin and walk in the wonderment of God's knowledge and truth. Oh, there's so much that we could say, brethren, but I'm just trying to make some points here. Also in connection with that, when we went to the Cairo Museum, and this is the museum which we could have stayed at for a couple of days, when we considered some of the treasures of Egypt, and when we had the same man taking us from one room into the other, explaining the early period of Egyptian history, the middle, and then the latter period, and each period having its own uniqueness, its own ideas and beliefs. For example, in the earlier period, they believed that the Pharaoh was the incarnate God. He was the son of the many gods, of Amun, who was really like the Grecian Zeus, the chief god, but having many other in his heavenly courts. And he was the earthly representative, a kind of trinity-like. And then in the second period, when the pharaohs died, they then got the idea of animal worship. And so when a pharaoh would die, they would immediately scour the countryside and select a bull according to certain prescribed ritual. And the bull would be selected, and he was conceived to be the reincarnation of the pharaoh. And the bull would be idolized, he'd be worshipped, he would be treated as a deity, and he would be given, you may have seen the symbol of the two horns and the round sun disk in the middle. This is a symbol of the reincarnated pharaohs. And in turn, when these bulls died, they were treated just like the pharaoh. They were mummified. They were put in beautiful tombs, and they were given huge sarcophagus. They were inscribed and sculpted, and they were treated as though they were God. Again, the exceeding sinfulness of sin. But as we went through the Cairo Museum, we went into one room. And I wish I had my pictures here. We went into one room, and the guide stops in front of a mummy. And he says, "This is King Akhenaten of the 18th dynasty, a most unusual and a most fascinating period in the history of the Egyptians. In this one man, King Akhenaten, and his wife Nefertiti, who I think is the one who you see mostly picturesque as a pharaoh's wife. I think Carmela may have a picture on one of her bags of Nefertiti. The guide said that this is the most unusual chapter in the history of Egypt, because out of all this worship of bulls and of men and of the sun and of the elements, there came in the reign of King Akhenaten a complete and unusual revival and a cleansing of their religious practice. In the life of this man, and he reigned no more than 18 years, he suddenly threw out all of the worship, the heathen worship in the temples. He deposed the god of Ammon, and he began to preach monotheism. He began to preach that there is only one God. He began to preach that there was a God whose symbol is the sun, and he called his god Atum. And he began to downgrade the priests, and the priests became very jealous, and they conspired to overthrow him. He expunged from all the statues any reference to Ammon and any polytheism. And he began to write poetry about the goodness of God, and the name Aton meant Lord of Love, and the symbol was the sun. Now the guide said, "Well, now how do you account for this? All of a sudden, out of Egyptian history comes this whole revision of emphasis amongst the pharaohs." Now when he died, immediately, all the old order was reinstituted. The famous King Tut, whom you've heard about, actually he was a boy who assumed the throne at the age of 9 and lived until the age of 18. And the only reason why we know King Tut was because his was the one tomb, and he was a minor pharaoh, that was not plundered. And if you could see the wealth in that very small tomb, and I have some pictures of it to show, if you could see the wealth and the gold and the treasures and the artistry that was buried with King Tut, because these pharaohs believed they would need all of these things in the world to come, it would just give you an idea as to the wealth of that land. But the only reason why we remember King Tut is because his tomb happened to be found undisturbed. But it was King Tut who succeeded King Akhenaten, and immediately the old priesthood was reinstituted, and the old darkness came there darker than ever. But the mystery still remained. How come that King Akhenaten suddenly was one bright, you know, ray of inspiration in the life of Egypt? And it was so nice to hear the guide say, it is believed that this was the Pharaoh that was on the throne when Abraham, when God had given him the instruction to go to the land of promise, you remember, there was a famine in the land, that Abraham detoured and went into Egypt against the Lord's wishes. He went into Egypt and he was afraid about Sarah, his wife, and he said that she's my sister. Apparently this was the Pharaoh who was in Egypt at that time. And this tells me more about that life that Abraham lived than anything else. That he came into that land, and he was the one who believed in Jehovah, and in monotheism, and in a God of love and blessing to others. And it is assumed by even the worldly historians that it was Abraham who introduced to this Pharaoh a belief in the one God and the enlightenment that caused this revolution, you might say, in the history of Egypt. And it just for me was so wonderful to see what a life that Abraham must have led. How he let his light shine, and so eager was he to proclaim his faith that even the Pharaoh was so influenced by it. Well, then we went to the pyramids. And brethren, all that you've heard about the pyramids, you've not heard the half. Because you can go through your third volume and you can see pictures of it, and it's grand and it's glorious. But rather than just standing by that edifice and just seeing the grandeurness of it, we can't imagine what 2.5 million blocks, average being over 2.5 tons each, when all heaped together, what they look like. Not only the external parts are so gripping, but when you go inside, and when you go into that fourth passage, and when you go into the ascending passage, how this does so beautifully portray the realities of God's plan. How going up that ascending passage, it is narrow, and you have to stoop, and it is slippery if they didn't have wooden cleats built in and handrails on the side for our convenience, but just imagine what it might have been without these helps. You would have to crawl on your hands and knees and slip back constantly because of the steepness of that ascending passage. And then when you come to the head of the passage and you come into that big step, and there you see the majesty of this grand gallery. 60 feet high and about 12 to 15 feet wide, and ledges on the side. You just are coming from a cramped position, all in aches and pains as you walk up that ascending passage, and suddenly you can open and breathe as you come into the grand gallery. It really is just like a brand new burst of liberty and freedom, and that's just what it pictured. The ascending passageway being the law dispensation, which could bring nothing to perfection, which was so hard for Israel to aspire to keep those commandments. But yet when Jesus brought life and immortality to light through the gospel, the release of this gospel age, and you can see this grand gallery about you with its recessed walls, seven indentations coming in towards the ceiling, and 40 slabs of stone forming the entire roof of this grand gallery. And as you look up, you see it inclining forward with ample helps for your walking up this way of life. The king's chamber, the queen's chamber, which was just in front, as you might see from your chart, if you recall, that the fourth passage and then the first ascending passage, the queen's chamber is the horizontal, that is right in front. That was graded off. That was the one part of the pyramid that we did not get to see. Because in there, one of the American universities has got a Geiger counter, and they are trying to prove a thesis. Some people say, and I think they're all wrong, that there are other chambers in the Great Pyramid of Giza that they have not found. And so they're trying to proved by the cosmic rays coming into the building whether or not there are any empty spaces in any part of the pyramid. And so they got these counters set up in various positions to then count the number of rays, and if there are more coming from one direction, they would assume maybe that there's a hollow spot, and they would be looking there for any additional rooms or chambers. So we were not able to get into the queen's chamber. But as we walked up the grand gallery, and as we got to the top and again that big step, and we looked forward into the king's chamber, it was a wonderful sight. To go in under the granite leaf, and then to stand up after the leaf, and then to go under again into the chamber. Here was a dark room of about, it looked to be about 40 square cubic feet, 40 by 40 by 40. And there against one end of the room was the sarcophagus, an empty tomb, just as you've seen it pictured. But you get a feeling of real sanctity and a feeling of real reverence as you walk into that room. Now the two air vents that are going out, and you could just light a match and hold it right in front of the air vent, and you can see how that vent was actually ventilating that room. Now, brethren, there's so much we could say about what we saw in the pyramid and what was done. Two brethren were doing a great deal of unusual exploration. In fact, it was somewhat dangerous. I wish I could go into what they were trying to do, but let me just illustrate that Brother Shalu and Brother Tonquist wanted to get into the upper part of the king's chamber. Only two people before had ever gotten there, and they wanted to get measurements and pictures. There were no accurate pictures made. Now, this is the king's chamber, and this is about 40 feet high, well, 60 feet high, actually, from there to there. And about maybe 80 feet above that were five layers of granite and some hollow spaces in between. Now, no one really knew what's in these spaces and how big these spaces are. Some years ago, a man by the name of Davidson was the first one to go in there. What he did was to force a passage from the top of the grand gallery through the stones until he came to one of these hollow spaces, and then drill through those layers to go right to the very top. He was looking for treasure. But Frank and Ernest, Frank and August, were thinking they'd like to go in to look for just what the sizes are and to see some of the hieroglyphics, you know, that were there. This is one of the places they had not been. And so they asked Brother Bordes from Detroit and myself to kind of be with them at 5 o'clock when the pyramid was closed. And they'd gotten special permission from the Ministry of Antiquities of the Egyptian government. And Carmela could tell you some interesting discussions she had with this very minister, a government official. He was very interested in the Bible students because we were a group that really loved the pyramid. And he saw that. In fact, I think he told Carmela, this is your pyramid. We were not interested in the others. But we showed such an interest here that he really couldn't understand why anyone would be so interested in this, what he called a tomb. This is just where they, you know, they wanted to put a pharaoh, and he wanted to remember himself in history. But they were so kind that they let us go to any place in the pyramid that we wanted. And our group got into the pit, the grotto, way down in the subterranean passages, where I understand no other group before, as a group, had been allowed to go. And we had full run of the place. But after 5 o'clock, nobody was there, and we had special permission, the four of us, to just stay around and see what we could do to help. So Kenneth and I were asked to kind of help Frank and August. August had, well, again, I have a picture I can show you, contrived a special ladder. And he studied this out, and it was 60 feet long, and it was simply a slender aluminum rod with little collapsible steps. And at the top of it was a big hook like that. And the idea was to get this ladder up and to hook it onto that stone up there and then climb up it. Well, it was fun, and it worked. And they hooked it up, and there the brethren climbed up there. And there was the hole. And while they were going up, all of the dust, you know, was just coming down, and the bats were flying out of the air. So we were standing there, you know, and when they got there, they threw down the nylon cord, and we attached down their photographic equipment, and they pulled it up. Now, the next 2 hours, they were up there, rummaging around, taking pictures, and Ken and I were down below, you know, waiting for something to happen, and also just being thrilled with the surroundings, and running into the king's chamber, you know, and taking pictures, which, by the way, none of them came out in the king's chamber. It was so dark there. It was so dark there that you needed special lighting effects. And the ordinary flashlight bulb that at least I had wasn't sufficient illumination. But we did get some pictures, which we will be happy to show. But afterwards, they came down after 2 hours, all like a chimney sweep. I'm sure in Scotland, brother, they had these chimney sweeps. Can you imagine how they looked when they came down? Well, that's the way these brethren looked. But they went all the way up to the top here, and they got pictures and made measurements of all of these chambers. Then before leaving, that was the next day. Next day, they wanted also to make the complete tour of the grotto and of the well. The last time they were there, they only got halfway. And so they wanted to go from this point way down to this subterranean chamber. And it was done quite simply by taking that nylon rope and tying it at the top and pulling it down with a weight until it rolled right down the well shaft to the bottom. And then, and this must have been about a good 80 or 90 feet more, and then just pulling themselves up the rope and going from one end of the well up to the other. And there they again explored it to see what there may have been there. Very few people have ever been in either that place or up on the upper reaches of the king's chamber. Now they're going to, you know, write a little book or something about some of their findings, and we're always interested in literature, but we always, of course, give it its due weight, and we make up our own minds about how valid the findings might be. But there can be no question as to the dedication and the desire of the brethren to find out and to really, you know, search and to learn and to probe what is the mystery that the Lord has for us in this great monument which he has built in the midst of the land at the Delta of Egypt. Well, brethren, just so much more we could say about our Egyptian experiences there. We were there for 4 nights. Then we left at 3 o'clock in the morning. Again, you see how it disrupts your sleep patterns. We left at 3 o'clock in the morning in order to take a 5 o'clock or 5:30 flight out to Athens. In Athens, we were very fortunate in having some 8 or 10 hours. And there we had a chance to go around the city in one of these quick tours. And we saw the Acropolis, the Parthenon. We were on Mars Hill, where Paul gave his wonderful testimony. We went into some of the temples that they had. Temple of Jupiter we passed right by. And had a chance to go out in the streets of Athens, and it was just like New York City. I felt just as much at home there as I did, say, in Manhattan. You had no problem with the language, because if you knew a little German or if you knew English, somebody around always knew a little bit about English. Again, we met one or two of the brethren in the Athens class, but we couldn't communicate with them because they didn't know English. But one of our members of our group, Sister Agape Hodges, she stayed there with these brethren and some of her relatives while we were touring the city, and then joined the group in the afternoon when we left for Tel Aviv. Now, when we got to Tel Aviv, we went immediately to Jerusalem, a distance of about 40 miles. And in Jerusalem, we were in the Old City. This was, when we speak of the Old City, it means the city that is surrounded by the Great Wall. You know, we read about the Bible, about the gates of Zion, and about the hills of Zion, and about the walls of Jerusalem. Now, here they were. And we were right before them, and our hostel was right inside one of the main gates, the Jaffa Gates. And we were in the old part of the city. Right across the narrow street is the Crusader walls, dating back to 1200, where the Crusaders had built this ramparts, these towers, to hold off the Mohammedans. Right down the street was the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and I must tell you a little bit about that. Right nearby was Mount Moriah. And right there was the one structure that dominates the whole old city, the Dome of the Rock. It is that gold-topped mosque, that big dome, which was built over the rock where Abraham had offered up Isaac, on Mount Moriah. And as you go into the mosque, as we did, you take off your shoes, you see this lava, where people come and they wash themselves, they wash their feet, they wash their faces before they go into the temple itself, or into the mosque. And as you go into the mosque, you see this huge dome. And this has been pretty well authenticated as one of the few spots in Palestine which is really authentic, because there are so many claims and counterclaims, and every religion has its own spot for various things that have happened. But you could really see the flatness of this large rock. And underneath there was a hole, which since then was used for sacrifices, where the blood of the animal would drain through, because this rock was used for sacrificing in Solomon's temple, and was very sacred in all of the religious life of Israel, and also of Muslim as well. But we just saw so much, it's hard to begin to tell you how in Jerusalem we spent our time. We did walk the Via Dolorosa. This is the way where Jesus was supposed to have carried his cross. And they have what they call stations of the cross. There are about 14 of them. We went along the first three or four, these narrow, very picturesque streets. We went to the place which, as far as we could ascertain, this was the place where Jesus was beaten. He was brought before a Pilate and condemned. They now have a church, very well kept. But as he then left this place and walked down this narrow street, there was an intersection. And here I thought it was very interesting. Tradition has it that he then turned to the left and went on to the spot where he was crucified, which was today represented under the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Now, this is the spot that was finally selected during the Crusaders' time during Charlemagne's time, when it was decided by Charlemagne's wife, who had a vision, that this must have been the spot where Jesus was crucified. And the bishop at that time of the church also concurred, and they found a few pieces of wood which they claimed was the crosses on which Jesus and the thieves were crucified, and they said this is the spot. Then they built a big Holy Sepulchre temple over it. Brethren, we went into that temple and I was nauseous. I was heartsick. But I was glad I went just the same. We went into this temple with all of its icons because I think the Greek Orthodox and the Roman Catholics both share it. The icons, the lamps hanging from the ceiling, the incense smelling, the priests intoning all over. And then you would wait in line because there was mobs trying to see. One little room, maybe about, no more than from there to the end, and then half from here to the wall. One little room, only about half a dozen people could fit in there at any one time. We waited our turn to get in. And this is what the priest was praying at, and was supposed to be the place where Jesus was entombed. And when you went in there, all you saw was a finely polished slab of marble on top of a little slab of marble and money thrown on top of it. Now, as we thought, I say I was heartsick, because nothing of the scriptures was fulfilled by that particular sight. The scriptures said that his tomb was a hollowed out place. The scriptures say that his tomb was outside the city. This was well within the city. The scriptures say it was in the garden, and there was nothing around this place that would indicate there was anything like a garden spot. But actually, then, we were able to leave that place and our reaction to it, and to realize the commercialism and how the Christianity has been so prostituted and made into merchandise. We then walked back and we rejoined the Via Dolorosa, that's the Street of Tears, and got to the point beyond, I think, the third station, where there is a turn to the left and a turn to the right. It is the turn to the left that tradition says that Jesus carried his cross, which leads to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. But if you turn to the right, you then take that path that goes up and leads out to a huge gate, the most popular gate at that time, called the Damascus Gate. And you see these big walls and this kind of entrance or exit out of the walls. And Jesus, we have every reason to believe, took this right-hand turn and went out through the Damascus Gates outside of the city. Now, we know that these Damascus Gates were the original gates. Because as you go outside the gates, you can look down and you see the original foundations of the gate. The new city, the new walls, was built on top of the old walls. If you could excavate, Palestine, and in fact we saw this in Ashkelon with the Brother Livermore. Boy, I must get on. You can just see the history of 6,000 years right in the sands. You see one layer upon another layer. You can go there and pull out pottery or pieces of pottery out where, a city was destroyed and sacked and burned down. Another city was raised on top of that, and that in turn was destroyed. Another was on top of that. It's an archaeological gold mine. But in the Damascus Gate, you could see where the new gates were built over the old. So this was outside the city. That's the important point. That outside the city had to be outside of the gate of Damascus. And if Jesus was buried outside, he would have to come through this way. Now, when you go outside the gates of Damascus and you walk across the street, there's a rather wide thoroughfare, and now they've built a bus stop right in front of what certainly must have been Golgotha, the Mount, or Calvary. It passed by, nobody pays any attention to it. But actually, you could see the outlines almost of the skull, the eyes and a little bit of the nose. And on top of this little mountain was a cemetery. Now, actually, the Mount Moriah consisted of the mount where the Dome of the rock where Abraham offered up Isaac, and actually the mountain extended out towards the Damascus Gate and really covered and included this place of the skull. Because what they did, they dug into the mountain to make these roadways. And you can see the heights, and then it inclined, and then you see the roadway, then you see these heights again. And we were able to take pictures to show the strata, you know, the strata of the place of the skull, and looking back at some of the strata you could see in the foundation work of the mountain, you certainly saw that they were identical or similar, and that these were two parts of the same mountain. Now the beauty of that is, brethren, simply, that Mount Moriah, you see, was the place where Abraham offered Isaac, and Mount Moriah was the place where Jesus was crucified. There's where God offered up his son. And it was within a very short distance, no more than maybe a quarter of a mile of the two places. And there's no reason to doubt that that place of the skull was truly a part of Mount Moriah. And I think it's so beautiful when you see it in its natural setting, and you can see the revulsion of the way Christianity has pictured the crucifixion and the burial place. Now, another place which was so beautiful was the tomb. That near this mount, near this place of the skull, where there is this burial place, you're in a cemetery which was used by Christians and Mohammedans. And right down the hill, you come into one of the most loveliest parts of Jerusalem. It is called the Garden Tomb. It is here where it is believed that Jesus was buried. And one thing that impressed everyone, when you came into this little garden, it was so well preserved, but there was a man there who is a minister from Holland. And we can say what we will, brethren, about nominal people and those who don't know the truth. But I'll tell you, this man spoke. As he guided people around, he always wanted to give them a little discourse first, a kind of reverential, inspirational talk. But the way this man talked about the life of Jesus and the meaning of Jesus' life and his death as a ransom sacrifice and what it means to live a resurrected life and the way he spoke of consecration, I tell you, the brethren were all very much impressed by this man. We talked with this man later, and he was speaking about the trouble that's coming upon the world. He, you know, he believed that Jesus was coming very soon. He was a real devoted Christian. And he talked about the great time of darkness that he sees abroad, and how he is devoting his life to helping people who come to this garden tomb to get a sense of what the living Christ could mean to them. And it was really an inspirational touch, and people like Ruth Millard and Charles Thornton and other brethren, they all felt that this was one of the real inspirational parts of our trip. It was a man who was really consecrated to what he believed to be the will of God. Then we saw the tomb, and everything seemed to indicate that this was the spot. It was a former rubbish heap. It was sealed over. It was formerly, obviously, they had built a little church around it, because you could see the outlines of the church. The stones had been worn away of people going in. There's just so much to identify this as being authentic. And we have a few books that might help if anyone's interested in reading about this and the position of the garden itself. So I've got to move on because I see our time is up. Then we met Brother and Sister Bleachards. It was so good seeing Mitchell and Becky and Faith and little Mark. The children were going to Hebrew school. They couldn't go into regular school because they didn't know the language, but little Mark was picking up Hebrew very well, and Faithy was a little lonesome. She only had one or two friends to play with. Mitchell is in the chemical company. The company has just been merged, and there's been a little bit of a shift. He says that he has had opportunity to talk about promises of God and the worship of God and the future of Israel. He says he talks about Messiah and Christ, but has not been given too much opportunity, but he is seeing the way the Lord overrules matter. The big problem there is transportation. If you buy a Volkswagen or a car, you've got to pay 100% tax. If you buy a gallon of gas, you've got to pay 60 agrats, which is, I suppose, comparable to about 60 cents, would you say, in American money, or not too much from it. It was pretty, expensive in accordance with their income. But Mitchell said he is going to buy a Volkswagen so that he can go down to Escalon with the Livermores and start having meetings together, because they felt a kind of a deprivation and a need for it. We went to the Mitchell's department. They have a apartment in a house, I think, with five other people. By Israeli standards, it's comfortable. It's luxurious. By our standards, we'd say it's people in the middle, in the low income housing, have a much nicer place. But that's not to say that they don't have a nice house. It's four rooms. They're small. They have the basic comforts. The thing that I thought was most uncomfortable was the gas range, or the electric range, only having two little burners. I should imagine a housewife would have a problem, you know, with just two burners. The plumbing is fair, according to August Tornquist's standards. But the brethren are rejoicing, and they seem to be looking to the Lord for his guidance and for his leading. And by the way, they all sent their special love to you. I singled out practically all of you and said, Brother Dinwiddie, Sister Dinwiddie, and Sister Pennington, I mentioned, I think, and Brother Chester, and Brother Teklinski, by name, all sent their greetings to you, and they want to be personally remembered to you as well. I think it might be nice if sometimes we remember them in cards, or, you know, send a little letter to them every now and then, because they appreciate hearing from their friends here. There's just so much to talk about Jerusalem that we... Oh, I could talk to you about Jericho and the amount of temptation, how it was fascinating to take a car and to go outside of the city and to go through Bethany. And now I began to see why Jesus loved to come to Bethany. It's just outside the surroundings, and it's a desert place with a lot of green spots, but just rolling hills and just little houses, you know, nestling under trees. It just gave me the feeling of peace and quietness and tranquility. And I just thought how Martha and Mary were there and how they were so hospitable. And the Master just loved to get away from it all and take their hospitality. But when you go through Bethany, you go through some winding passages. And if you go on for about another 20 miles or so, you come to the Dead Sea. It's the lowest point on the face of the globe. It's 1,300 feet below sea level. And the Dead Sea is just... it's a wide expanse of water, but it's just barren, and it's dark. It was dark green when I saw it. Some brethren say it was blue when they saw it. But there's nothing that lives around it. And you get the smell of salt in the air, and for hundreds of feet around it, you just see the crystalline salt. You just see the salt, you know, just laying around on top of stones. And then we went down to the Dead Sea Scroll Qumran caves where the scrolls were found. And then we went back to... the town of Jericho, and there saw the foundations of some of the walls of Jericho. And then we could see, right far from us, what is believed to be the Mount of Temptation. I always thought that the Mount of Temptation was right in Jerusalem, or right near Jerusalem, right nearby. But no, it's about 20 of our miles out, about 30 kilometers away. And I can see why it would be called the Mount of Temptation. It's just a huge, bare hunk of rock. And it's the biggest, the tallest of mountains around there. And it just juts right up, and you can see that to get up there even must be quite a hike and climb. There's a monastery on top, a flat, you know, long building. And it was so bleak and barren and gloomy looking. We got there late in the afternoon. You get the feeling how the adversary would, you know, tempt anyone at that point. And you could get the feeling how he lifted him up on a high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms, because this was a reasonably high peak, and you could see all around you. And you could see some of the fertile parts of Jericho. It's like a little oasis there. Then we went up to the old city of Jericho. It's considered the oldest city in existence, and mud flats, nothing but just beat up hunks of ground, and people were still living in this as a settlement. Then we went, well, there's just so many things that we did see, it's hard for me to describe. Then when we left Jerusalem, and I might say too, that we were at Jerusalem at this hostel, which is run by the Anglican Church. It's called Christ Church Hostel. And it was, you know, the accommodations were where you had to go out in the hall, showers were not very convenient, and the rooms were somewhat narrow, and the beds were a little bit creakety, you know, and crooked. Carmela still has a sore in the back, but this was no hindrance whatever. We just rejoiced in it all because it gave us a real feeling of being in the land. But there was the father-in-law of the man who's taking care of the place and the minister of the church asked if he could give a talk on prophecy. And the brethren debated, should we hear this man out? He's an 89-year-old man. And so we talked together, should we listen? Well, we said, well, let's make it optional at night if somebody wants to hear. Let's hear what this man has to say. We knew that the minister, or they called him the warden of the hostel and the minister of the church, he was somewhat prejudiced against the Jews, because he had a ministry towards Jordanian Arabs and trying to convert Jordanian Arabs into Christianity. And now when the Jews came along and they chased out the Jordanian Arabs, much of their labor, you know, was lost. But we asked the old man if he wanted to. Sure, we'd be glad to hear him out. And you know, it was really wonderful. He was a man almost blind. He couldn't see, and some of the brethren had to read the scriptures for him. But the scriptures that he was reading from and quoting was just like Bible students. You know, it really, you know, for the three quarters of his talk, I thought I was listening to like Brother Dinwiddie or one of our brethren giving a talk on prophecy. How God would bring the Jews back to Israel. How the Jews would be gathered after the scattering, and how they would be united. There would be a time of Jacob's trouble for them, that Gog and Magog would come down, and that what we are seeing today is the uniting. There was the hunting done by these other Hitler and these other ones, and now he's Zionism trying to draw them together. And it was marvelous. He was really giving us a message that Brother Russell, I'm sure, gave in the Hippodrome. Then, you know, as he got to the end, he said, well, therefore, we're now waiting for the return of Christ. And he's going to come down here on the mountain and read Zephaniah 14 and one foot on one side, one foot on the other side of the valley. He gave a rather nominal interpretation of that. But that seemed to be the only point where we would say that this man did not understand as we did. And it was so wonderful, you know, to get this kind of testimony. And we had a nice chance. He had heard of Pastor Russell. He said that there was much prejudice against Pastor Russell in England, where he was living during Brother Russell's day. And so he had not, read his books. Now, I don't know where he got all this information from, but he said he did not read the books. So some of the brethren said, well, if we give you the books, will you read them? He said, yes. So he's getting a set of books. But, you know, I will say this, that I was surprised by the amount of opportunity that was given to all the friends to witness in Israel. Now, you know, that was one of the things why we went there. I'm not going overboard. I'm not trying to say that we are, you know, it's great things to be done and I'm being fooled by a very limited experience. And this was a subject of discussion. A couple of the brethren took the Livermores to task and said, well, why are you spending consecrated time here? You should be with the brethren and the workers taught together in the church, not taught here in Israel. And they really had quite a discussion. Because Brother Livermore gave a talk, and Brother Mitchell gave a talk at night, you know, in our fellowship together. And there was a difference, you know, as to should we be doing this work or should we be doing something somewhere else? And I think it was an agreement that, well, you've made your position, I've made my position, and, you know, let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. But there was a free exchange of what is the mission of the church. But I will say this, in that exchange, we were all surprised by the amount of opportunity we all had to talk about the Bible and to talk about, you know, the time of trouble and to talk about, you know, what's coming and even talk about Jesus. We would go into shops and we would have a chance, you know, to raise this. We'd go into shops and we'd find that they are believers and that we've had several people say that there's more belief in Jesus amongst the Jews than we realize because they're afraid to publicly express it. But there's a good deal of faith. Now, brethren called on one or two names that they had from people here in the United States. One brother had a business acquaintance who asked to call upon a Hebrew man who had been in Israel for about 15 years. Well, when Brother Charles and Brother Kenneth Bordes called on this man, They were there for a couple of hours into the hours of the morning because they began telling this man about the truth and about Messiah and about the kingdom. The man said, don't go. Keep telling us more. He said, this is wonderful. You know, this is, I've heard some of this and other people believe it. And they felt kind of pleased, you know, that there may be some activities. Now, I heard that since we left, that Brother August and his wife stayed 2 days behind, that they had a very fascinating experience. They were able to witness the two different families about Christ and about the meetings. They brought these families to the Mitchells, and Livermores were there too at that time. And apparently, if I'm correct, you correct me in this, Carmela, that Sister Tornquist mentioned to Carmela that there's hope that these two families, will be coming together and meeting with the Livermores and the Mitchells and starting a meeting together. Now this, you know, this certainly the brethren there are going to meet together. And there was some talk about there's a possibility of getting some interest even now. Now who knows, brethren? Who knows? We are not to always say that, you know, we don't know how God is working. Perhaps God does want a few over there to begin to get associated with the land and to understand the people, so that if there is to be any interest at all, that they would be there available to be helpful in whatever directions the harvest work might take. We don't know. All I'm asking is that we certainly keep, you know, our eyes and ears open to see whatever the Lord's directions might lead. And as he dictates, I'm sure his consecrated brethren will follow. But it was a rather exciting experience. Then he went down to Ashkelon, where the Livermores live, and had fellowship with them. And then I can't tell too much more about what we saw there. It was very helpful too. And then went to Tel Aviv for 2 days and took an airplane flight all around the Sinai Peninsula, went over Mount Sinai, went over the battlefields, went down to the Gulf of Eilat, the Gulf of Aqaba. We saw the Red Sea, where all this fighting had taken place and how the Jewish armies had gotten in. And we had a chance to bathe in the Gulf of Eilat. Then went back to Tel Aviv the next morning, took the plane, and come back here after 15 hours of journey. So, brethren, I'm over my time, but I hope I've given you a little bit of a feeling as to what it's like to go to the land of Israel and to see some of the places and to walk where Jesus walked. I must confess that I have a much better appreciation. For example, when I read the Mount of Transfiguration, when we went up Mount Tabor, you know what it means to go up there and the sight that you see from there. I have a much better appreciation of, you know, the land that Jesus walked and some of the terms that they used and some of the surroundings that they describe in the scriptures. And I can appreciate it with much more vitality and with much more vividness than otherwise. You can read about these things, but you know what they say? One picture or one glance is worth a thousand words. It certainly was a blessing. And I think the brethren, as they came back, unanimously felt it was certainly an opportunity that we were all glad that we took. About the trip itself, it was organized by the brethren. One brother got the idea that maybe we ought to go together and asked Frank to be more or less our guide in Israel, Frank Shalou, that is. But Brother Destro took all responsibility for passage, arranging, and it's a lot of work when you're conducting a tour. Things have got to be on time, and you've got to make sure that dozens of people are doing their jobs so as to make the group's experience easy. But the way it all moved so beautifully, I say, dear friends, that truly it was a blessing which, thank the Lord, we were privileged to utilize. And so I hope that you've been drawn a little closer to the land of promise as a result of our little travelogue together. I wonder if we might omit the hymn and just rise and ask Brother Chester to conclude us with a word of prayer.
Our loving God and Father, indeed we're thankful that we're able to assemble ourselves this stage, get a little deeper insight into thy wonderful promises and wonderful insight into this wonderful land. Our Savior has been dwelling, dear Father, and indeed we can appreciate through our minds, through the little visions set before us, And more appreciate thy prophecies, dear Father, so that we could serve thee more diligently, and also to acknowledge in our hearts a deeper faith and a deeper understanding, that we may give our lives more carefully in serving thee, thy plans and purposes, acknowledging that all these things are so, and that there will be a time, dear Father, when we'll have an even greater understanding of these things that took place, and be able to comprehend all things. So we thank thee, dear Father, thou hast given us